You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 143 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Three Paths to Christ. This is Lecture 5. Given in Munich on the 25th of February, 1912, entitled Reflecting Levels of Consciousness. Today and the day after tomorrow, it will be my task to discuss some of the more important aspects of consciousness and karmic connections. Essentially, I would like to follow on from the topics of yesterday's public lecture. Our situation is such that in public lectures for a wider audience, certain matters have to be presented differently from the way in which it is possible to consider them in branch meetings, because branch members, having worked together and concerned themselves over longer periods with such material, have been prepared to receive and understand things in a way that cannot apply to larger public settings. We saw yesterday that we could speak about hidden aspects of human soul life, and we need to contrast these unseen soul aspects with the specifics of normal everyday consciousness. If you cast a superficial glance at the concepts, moods, impulses of will, in addition to all the perceptions with which we are faced from the external world, from waking in the morning to falling asleep at night, you have a collection of what can be called the sum of everyday consciousness. Everything contained in our conscious daily life, all this depends on the instrument of a physical body. You find the most immediate and obvious proof of what has just been said in the fact that human beings have to wake up in order to participate in the actualities of normal conscious life. For us, this means that they have to dive down into their bodies with the elements that remained outside their physical bodies during sleep. Their physical bodies, as tools or instruments, need to be at their disposal for the facts of daily living to take place. The question immediately arises, how does a human being as a spiritual entity make use of the physical instrument of their body, of their senses and their nervous system, in order to live their daily life? In the material world, the belief persists that human beings experience the reality of their consciousness as a product of their physical instrument. I have often drawn attention to the fact that this is not so, and that we should not imagine that, say, our brain or sense organs might produce our state of consciousness, just as little as a candle would produce a flame. It is the case that the relationship to our physical instrument of what we call consciousness is quite different. We can compare it to the relationship between a person who sees themselves in a mirror and that mirror itself. When we are asleep, we live in our consciousness, as if we were to go straight into a room. If we go straight into a room, we do not see ourselves. We do not see what our noses or our foreheads look like. Only at the moment when someone steps forward holding a mirror do we see ourselves. Then what had existed throughout approaches us. It is then visible to us. It is similar with the realities of our everyday consciousness. They exist continuously within us. Of themselves, they have as little to do with our physical bodies as our individualities have to do with a mirror. Materialistic theories in this field are nothing but nonsense. They are not even a plausible hypothesis, because what the materialist asserts can only be compared with the claim that because people can see themselves in a mirror, it is the mirror that produces them. If you want to submit to the illusion that the mirror produces you because you only see yourself when a mirror is held up to you, then you are also capable of believing that parts of your brain or your sense organs can bring forth the contents of your soul life. Both would be equally spiritually rich and equally true. claiming that mirrors produce people is just as true as stating that brains create thoughts. The realities of consciousness exist. We only need our organism to be able to perceive those realities of consciousness. For this, we need our physical body, which we see mirroring factual consciousness. Thus we have in our physical body something which we can call a mechanism for mirroring or reflecting the occurrences of our daily consciousness. This is how the facts of our normal consciousness live in our soul spiritual being. We perceive them in that what exists in us, which our souls, however, cannot perceive, just as we cannot see ourselves until a mirror is placed in front of us, has the mirror of physicality placed in front of it. That is the factual state of affairs. Only in our bodies we do not have a passive instrument of reflection, but something in which processes take place. You can therefore imagine that instead of the mirror being coated so as to produce a reflected image, all sorts of processes have to go on behind it. This comparison is sufficiently extensive to really characterize the relationship of our soul spiritual being to our physical bodies. We would like to posit that for everything we experience in everyday consciousness, the physical body is the corresponding reflective device. Behind, or if you like, below, these events of normal consciousness are also those components which well up into normal soul life, and which we know to be realities living in the hidden depths of our souls. Poets and artists experience something of this, if they are a true poet or artist, when they are aware that they are not inspired by logical considerations, nor by what they perceive in the normal course of events, but by what emerges from unknown depths and does really exist, without having been constructed by the forces of normal consciousness. Yet other elements emerge from the veiled depths of our soul life. Here we have influences which, without us normally being aware of their origins, play into our daily consciousness. We saw yesterday that we can delve much deeper into the realm of semi-consciousness, the realm of dreams. And we know that dreams rise upward from the hidden recesses of soul life, and that we cannot simply or conventionally dredge them up through the exertions of our consciousness. When a dream picture, long buried in memory, emerges in the soul, as so often happens, it is the case that by far the majority of people would never, through sheer contemplation, be in a position to retrieve such pictures from the subterranean repositories of their souls, because their normal consciousness does not reach deep enough. However, what lies beyond the reach of normal consciousness is readily accessible to the subconscious. In that semi-conscious state of dreaming, what has been relegated to storage in oblivion can be hauled up. It is dislodged, and it breaks out. Only such things surface as have not found expression, have not had their effect in the usual way that forgotten, submerged things of the soul's depths find their outlet in experience. We become healthy or sickly, ill-humored or cheerful, not due to factors that usually affect the course of our lives, but as a physical state, which, as a result of our life experience, having been suppressed and no longer remembered, works on in our soul, shaping the person we become in life. Many lives would be quite explicable if we knew what had become submerged over the course of that life. We would understand individuals much better in their 30s, 40s, or 50s if we could trace their lives back to childhood. We would then know why they were in a particular state, why they felt so deeply dissatisfied with this or that relationship, without being able to say what has caused their distress. Were we able to do this, we would arrive at a view as to why parents and other individuals in the child's surroundings had affected that child, what joy and sorrow, what enthusiasm or pain had been caused, all of which may have been completely forgotten, but which has had its effects in the entire disposition of that person. Because What has rolled downward out of our consciousness works on, causing waves in the buried depths of the soul. The strange thing is that what is continuing to work affects us ourselves first and foremost, remaining within the sphere of our personalities. When clairvoyant consciousness descends to those levels, and this is achieved through imagination, through what we call imaginative knowledge, where the subconscious elements mentioned hold sway, it is here that the human individuality finds itself. It finds in itself what lives and undulates. And that is good, because human beings need to find themselves, must get to know themselves in true self-knowledge, must really look at all the instinctive forces working within them and truly recognize them. If human beings press onward with clairvoyant consciousness into their subconscious, having practiced exercises in imaginative knowledge, yet without being mindful that they will initially encounter only themselves, complete with everything that they are and they contain, they will be subject to the widest array of errors. This is because, in parallel with normal modes of consciousness, one is not in the slightest aware that one is only dealing with oneself. At a certain point, it can happen that one has visions, or, let's say, sees figures, which are completely new in the context of what one has hitherto garnered through life experience. That can happen. Were one to imagine, however, that these must already be manifestations of higher worlds, one would be in the grip of serious delusion. Such things do not manifest in the same way as aspects of inner life appear to normal perception. If you have a headache, this is a fact of ordinary consciousness. You know that the pain is located in your head. If you have a stomach ache, you perceive this to be in yourself. If you descend into those depths we call the hidden recesses of soul, you can only be within yourself, and yet you can construe what confronts you there as if it were external to yourself. As an example, let's take a striking case of someone who had the dearest wish to be the reincarnation of Mary Magdalene. I once related that I had encountered 24 Mary Magdalene cases in my lifetime. Let's assume that someone admits to no such wish. We don't need to admit our wishes to ourselves with our upper consciousness. That is not necessary. So, someone reads the story of Mary Magdalene in the Bible and is extremely taken with it. Simultaneously, in their subconscious, the desire can grow to be Mary Magdalene. In their upper consciousness, they have nothing more than an admiration of this figure. In their subconscious, such that they know nothing of it, a certain greedy ambition to be this figure is engendered. This person now makes their way through the world. For as long as nothing else crops up, their daily consciousness, in other words, what they are aware of, simply approves of Mary Magdalene. Their subconscious, however, harbors a burning desire to actually be Mary Magdalene, though they are unaware of this. They are therefore unembarrassed by it. They proceed in accordance with the paradigm of their normal consciousness. They can go about the world without their upper consciousness being troubled by any desire to be Mary Magdalene. But let's imagine that by applying some occult means or other, such a person is able to access their subconscious. They descend into their subconscious. They do not need to notice the fact that, quote, in me is a voracious wish to be Mary Magdalene, close quote, in the same way as one would notice a headache. Were they to notice this mania to be Mary Magdalene, they would have a chance to be sensible. They would behave in relation to this desire in the same way as they would toward a headache. They would try to get rid of it. But when such an abnormal intrusion happens, it does not proceed like that, but instead situates the lust outside the personality as an external fact, as a vision. You are Mary Magdalene. It confronts the person. It projects itself as fact. A person of today, as presently constituted in terms of their development, is then not in a condition capable of controlling such a fact with their I, with their ego. Under conditions of good, proper, and absolutely meticulous schooling, This cannot happen, because our eye accompanies us into every sphere. However, as soon as something happens within our eye accompanying us, it will appear to us as an objective external verity. Observers then believe themselves to remember back to the events in and around Mary Magdalene and feel themselves to be identical with that Mary Magdalene. This is quite possible. I emphasize this risk today because from it you should see that it is only through careful training, the care with which you find your way into occult matters, that can save you from falling victim to such errors. If you know this, that you must first see an entire world in front of you. You must perceive facts, verities, but not as something that you apply to yourself, not as something which is within you, yet which appears as a world tableau. If you know that, you will do well to regard what you first see as a projection of your own inner life. Then you will have a robust means of counteracting the errors along this path. That is the very best course, initially to regard everything as facts or events arising out of yourself. These usually stem from our desires, vanities, ambitions, in short, from those qualities connected with our own egoism. These things are primarily projected outward, and you may ask, how can we avoid such errors of illusion? How can we protect ourselves from them? In the normal state of consciousness, you will not avoid them. Error comes about precisely when you place such a world tableau in front of yourself in reality, but cannot extricate yourself from yourself. You remain enmeshed within yourself. From this you will gather that it actually depends on us somehow getting out of ourselves, somehow learning to distinguish. Here is one vision, here is a different vision, both of them external to us. One vision may only be the projection of a desire, the other a factual reality. Yet these visions are not as different from each other as, in normal life, someone else saying they have a headache and you yourself having one. One's own interior is equally projected into space as is someone else's. How can we become capable of differentiating? Within the occult field, we must learn to differentiate. We need to distinguish true impressions from false ones, even though they all intermingle and all arise, claiming a similar right to authenticity. It is as if we were to look out into physical nature, and among real trees see imaginary trees, between which we could not differentiate. As if cheek by jowl with real and phantasmal trees, there were real factual realities, which were external to us and only arose in our inner life. How can we learn to discriminate between these two realms which are interleaved with each other? One does not initially learn to discriminate through consciousness. If you remain only within the sphere of your imagination, you actually have no means of distinguishing. Whereas any potential for discernment lies solely in the slow, occult education of your soul. As we progress ever further, we do eventually learn to discriminate, and this means doing, in the inner occult realm, what we ought to have been capable of doing when those real and fantasy trees appeared side by side in front of us. We can pass through the fantasy trees, but we collide with the real trees. Something similar, but now obviously among spiritual facts, also has to come toward us in spiritual fields. If one proceeds correctly, it is relatively easy to discern the true from the false in this realm, not through concepts, but by a resolve of will. A willed resolve of this kind can come about in the following manner. When we review our lives, we find two clearly delineated and distinguishable groups of phenomena. We often find that some event is either successful or unsuccessful, and that we regularly link this with our own competence. Because we may not be very clever in a particular area, we can equally understand why things do not succeed there. On the other hand, where we can ascribe certain abilities to ourselves, we understand why outcomes are successful. Maybe we do not always need to make so explicit the correlation between our capabilities and what is carried out through our agency. There is a less clear-cut way of understanding this link. For instance, when someone in later life is affected by a stroke of destiny, they may think back and say to themselves, "I was someone who did not sufficiently bestir myself," or, "I have always been a reckless chap." On the other hand, they may be able to reflect, "It is not immediately clear to me how my downfall is connected with what I did, but it does occur to me that a reckless, lazy person cannot succeed in the same way as one who is conscientious and hardworking." In short, we understand that there are instances when success or failure is the result it turns out to be, while others fail to see any connection, reflecting, despite having this quality or that ability, which should have ensured success, it simply failed. There is, however, another sort of success or failure, in which we are, at first, unable to see how it is associated with our capacities. That is one thing. The other is that in the face of what we otherwise consider to be blows of destiny and the objective outer world, we can ponder, "Yes, it actually seems fair, because we provided all the preconditions for this to happen." Yet other things happen which may cause us to think that they just happen without us being able to find their cause. So we have two types of experience, those that stem from us and are connected with the capabilities we know we possess, and the other sort just characterized. And again, events for which we cannot admit to having provided the preconditions, as opposed to those to which we know that we have contributed. Let us review our lives a little. There is an experiment useful to everyone consisting of the following. We can all muster events in our lives whose causes we cannot fathom, successes on which we must conclude that, quote, "the blind chicken just found the grain," close quote, in cases that ascribe no credit to ourselves. We also summarize remembered instances of failure in the same terms. Then we can focus on external events which have struck us as coincidental and for which we know of no motivation nor cause. Now let's try the following experiment. We'll construct a somewhat artificial human made up precisely of those qualities which, unbeknown to us, contributed to our successes. If something has succeeded due to the essential wisdom we were too foolish to provide at the time, we construct for ourselves someone who is particularly wise in that area and for whom the undertaking ought to have succeeded. Or for an external event, we do this. Let's say a tile falls onto our head. Initially, we cannot fathom what caused this, but we imagine a person who has provoked this tile onto head event. They run up onto the roof and partially pull loose a tile such that they only need to wait a short while before it falls down. Then they run downstairs and the tile hits them. This is what we do with certain events, toward which we know perfectly well, in terms of our normal consciousness, that we have not ourselves contributed, events which in fact strongly counter our will. Say that someone hit us during our life. To soften this, we'll place it in our childhood. Imagine we had somehow engaged someone to beat us. We did everything to provoke this beating. We are constructing someone who takes upon themselves something, the context of which we cannot grasp. You see, if you wish to progress in occult matters, you have to accept certain things that contradict everyday facts. If you confine yourself to doing only what seems sensible in mundane terms, you will not make headway in occultism, because what pertains in higher worlds can at first seem irrational to the everyday mentality. So there is no harm if even the methods seem irrational to hard-headed prosaics. Hence we are building up this imaginary person. It may seem grotesque to be constructing such an entity while still unaware of its purpose, but anyone trying this will make an extraordinary discovery, namely that they do not want to rid themselves of the being they have so carefully fashioned, that it starts to interest them. If you try this out, you will see that you cannot rid yourself of this synthetic being. It just lives in you. Strangely, it not only lives in you, but it metamorphoses within you, so strongly, in fact, that it becomes something it was not previously. It becomes something we can only call a fixture in us. Anyone can try this out for themselves. From what has been described, from the being that is no longer the fantasy-built entity it was at the outset, it can be said that it is something existing within us. It is a product of the seemingly causeless events in our life. Thus you find in yourself an entity called into being by the otherwise inexplicable. In other words, what I have described is a path by which you can avoid gawping into your own soul's life in search of phenomena, but which is, instead, a way out of your soul life and into the surroundings. Because the things in which we do not succeed do not remain with us but belong to our surroundings. In this way, we have extracted from the environment something which does not correspond with our factual consciousness, but yet presents itself as if it were within us. You then have the feeling that you do, in fact, have some connection with whatever appears so inexplicable in your life. In this way, you can gain a sense of your connection with your destiny, with what we call karma. This soul experiment provides a genuine path for you to experience some degree of your karma in a more concrete manner. You might object, "I don't rightly understand what you are saying." But if you say that, you are not understanding what you believe you don't understand, yet which is childishly easy to understand. It is merely something about which you do not think. It is impossible for someone who hasn't tried this experiment to understand it, and only those who have actually carried it out will understand it. This description is no more than something anyone can attempt and experience. Everyone can arrive at the understanding that something exists in their inner life that is related to their karma. If they knew this from the outset, they would not need to be given guidance by which to find it. As a rule, it is entirely to be expected that someone who has not tried this will not grasp it. It is not a matter of understanding a report of something your souls can undertake. If your soul undertakes this route, it not only becomes accustomed to living inwardly in its desires and appetites, but to relate outer occurrences to itself, to really focus on outer events. It is to this that our souls become habituated. Precisely those things we have not ourselves wished for are the very things we have constructed into the true meaning of the matter in hand. And if we can arrive at a point where we relate to our destiny by accepting it with composure and not railing against it in the usual outraged way, we may think we accept it gladly because we have imposed it on ourselves. Then a frame of mind may ensue, which in any given situation and by entering into those hidden depths of soul is able to distinguish truth from falsehood, which can, with wonderful clarity and absolute certainty, differentiate between what is true and what is false. When looking at some visions with spiritual eyes, while putting aside all the forces perceptible to one's innermost being, having come to know them, and then, as it were, putting them aside, conjuring them away, and using only that inner gaze, they turn out to be mere phantasm. If, however, one cannot pull all this aside, as described, and can only get rid of what reminds one of the outer world, that is the visionary part, and the spiritual element remains as a firm fact, then it is true. This distinction cannot be made before having carried out what was described. There can be no certainty in distinguishing truth from falsehood at the spiritual level if the training described has not been carried out. The essential element of this soul experiment is this. With our normal consciousness, we are always accompanied by what we desire. Through this soul experiment, we become accustomed to seeing what our normal consciousness does not in the least want, something it would normally avoid, as something we have ourselves willed. In this sense, you can have attained a significant level in inner development. But if you have not, via this experiment and through your connection with all that you have not willed, taken a stand against the desires, the longings, the sympathies and antipathies inherent in your souls, you will make mistake after mistake. The biggest mistake in the present Theosophical Society has been made by H.P. Blavatsky, by directing her spiritual gaze toward the realm where Christ is to be found. But because in her desires, passions, and in short in everything existing in her upper consciousness, she also harbored an antipathy for, and an enduring and even passionate rejection of, everything Christian and Hebrew, she would show her preference for every spiritual culture spanning the earth. That is, every culture except Christian and Hebraic. And because she never undertook what has been described today, a totally false concept of Christ appeared to her, something naturally to be expected. This notion was transmitted from her to her closer pupils and continues to be touted around today, just coarsened into a grotesque form. These matters reach into the highest realms. One can see many things on an occult level, but the ability to discern is something quite different from mere vision, from mere perception. This needs to be starkly emphasized. Now the question is this. Basically, when we dive into the hidden depths of our souls, and every seer has to do this, we are initially submerged in ourselves. Through this, we need to become acquainted with ourselves so that we can really make the transition from the domain spread out before us, in which Lucifer and Ahriman constantly promise to grant us all the riches of the world. This means that our inner being is arrayed before us, and the devil states, "This is the objective world." Such precisely is the temptation, which even Christ himself could not avoid. The illusions of our own inner being are laid out. Yet Christ's energy was so strong that he instantly recognized that this was no real world, but that it existed within. It is only through this inner realm, in which we must discern two elements, one of which we can banish, that is, all that constitutes our own inner world, whilst the other remains, that we navigate through our soul's internal life and out into the objective, suprasensible world itself. Just as our spiritual core, to outer perception, in terms of the facts of normal consciousness, has to make use of the reflective capacity of our physical bodies, by the same token, in respect of their soul spiritual core, and of the spiritual, supersensible facts initially confronting them, must human beings use their ether bodies as a mirror, as a reflective mechanism. Those higher sense organs, if we may call them that, arise in the astral body. But what inhabits the astral has to be reflected in the ether body, just as the soul spiritual element of which we are aware in our everyday lives is mirrored by our physical bodies. Now, we need to learn to handle our ether bodies. This is quite natural, because though we are not usually aware of our ether bodies, it represents what enlivens us. So we must first get to know our ether body ourselves, before we learn to recognize what comes toward us out of suprasensible worlds, and which can be reflected in this ether body. What we experience by delving into the unseen depths of our souls, where we primarily encounter ourselves and the projection of our desires, is very similar to the state of being generally called Kamaloka. It is only distinguishable from actual Kamaloka by the fact that whilst one proceeds a normal life to a state of being locked within oneself, we have to call it that, our physical bodies are still present, and we can always return to them. Whereas, in Kamaloka, our bodies have departed together with even that portion of our ether bodies capable of reflecting us. Now, it is the all-embracing world ether surrounding us that serves as a reflective device and which reflects all that we contain. The period of Kamaloka is such that our inner life, consisting of all our desires and lusts, encompassing every aspect of our feelings and our disposition, assembles itself around us as our objective surroundings. It is important for us to understand that our life in Kamaloka is initially characterized as revolving around us, being locked into ourselves, and that this imprisonment within ourselves is all the more constrictive because we have no physical life to which we can return and to which our entire existence can relate. Only when we have undergone this life in Kamaloka in such a way that we eventually, and it is a very gradual process, arrive at the understanding that everything there cannot be got rid of from the world in any other way than that we can now feel in a manner quite differently than through desires, and so on. Only then can we break out of the prison that is Kamaloka. What does this mean? Let's assume someone dies harboring a particular desire. This desire forms part of what is projected out into the domain of Kamaloka and is built into the fabric surrounding them. As long as a desire persists in them, it is impossible for them to unbolt their life in Kamaloka. Only when they become aware that this desire can only be satisfied when it has been disengaged, given up, no longer wished for, in other words, when it is torn from their soul, and when they themselves oppose it, only then will the desire, and with it, all that confines them to Kamaloka, be severed from their soul. Only then do we reach the realm between death and a new birth, which we have called Devakan, a realm which can also be penetrated by clairvoyance, once one has recognized all that belongs only to oneself. In clairvoyance, this point is arrived at through a certain level of maturity, of readiness. In Kamaloka, it is over time, simply because time plagues us with our own desires, which are only conquered through duration, through endurance. This is how all that masquerades before us, fooling us into thinking it to be the world and all its glories, is shattered. The world of truly supra-sensory realities is called Devakan. How do we encounter this approaching world? Here on the earthly plane, we can only speak of Devakan because in clairvoyant vision, when the self has been fully surmounted, we enter into a world of spiritual facts, verities, which are objectively present and which are congruent with what exists in Devakan. Now, the most important characteristic of this Devakanic realm is that moral facts are no longer distinguishable from physical facts and laws, but that physical and moral laws are congruent. What does this mean? Isn't it so that in the ordinary physical world the sun shines alike on the just and the unjust? Those who have committed a crime can be sent to prison, but the physical sun is not eclipsed. This means that in the world of physicality, moral lawfulness and physical legitimacy diverge, each going its separate way. It is not like this in Devakan, not in the slightest. There it is the case that everything originating in what is moral, wisely intellectual, aesthetically beautiful and such like, leads to emergence and development, while all that proceeds from what is immoral, intellectually untrue, aesthetically repulsive, leads to destruction and downfall. In fact, there the laws of nature are such that the sun does not shine on righteous and wicked alike, but, if we may put this pictorially, that it really does darken in face of evil. The righteous individual going through Devakan also has spiritual sunshine there. In other words, the fructifying forces that help them progress in their lives. Spiritual forces withdraw from a deceitful or hateful person passing through. Processes are possible there that are not possible here. If two people walk along next to each other, one righteous and the other sinful, the sun cannot shine on the one and not the other. However, over in the spiritual world, it is absolutely the case that it depends on the quality of human being as to how spiritual forces work upon them. This means that over there, laws of nature and spiritual laws do not diverge into two separate paths, but are one and the same path. Fundamentally, everything depends on this. In the Devaconic world, laws of nature totally coincide, are completely congruent with moral and intellectual laws. For this reason, the following takes place. Once the human being has stepped into the world of Devakan and is living through this, they retain from their last life everything by way of righteousness and unjustness, of good and evil, of aesthetically beautiful or ugly, of truth and falsehood. But all this works in such a way that it is immediately subject to the laws of nature there. There the law, as we call it in the physical world, pertains that someone who has lied or stolen might turn toward the sun, yet not be shone upon. They would eventually contract an illness through lack of sunlight. Or, let us imagine someone who had lied could run out of breath in the physical world. This would be comparable with what takes place in the Devaconic world. Something like this happens to a person who has brought upon themselves some encumbrance or other in relation to their soul's spiritual nature. Natural laws are simultaneously and absolutely congruent with spiritual laws. As this person progresses onward and ever further onward through Devakan, such qualities gradually settle into the individual, so that what they now are corresponds with the qualities they brought with them from their previous life. Let us say that someone lingers for 200 years in Devakan, having consistently lied during their former life. They live out their time in Devakan, but the spirits of truth withdraw from them. What would be revived in a different soul, one used to speaking the truth, now dies in them. Let us now imagine someone of pronounced vanity who has failed to rid themselves of this trait and is going through Devakan. Here, vanity is an extraordinarily evil-smelling vapor, and certain spiritual beings avoid a foul-smelling individual, so pungently redolent of ambition and vanity. This is no pictorial figure of speech. Vanity and ambition really are exceptionally disgusting fumes in Devakan. And for this reason, the benevolent influence of certain spiritual beings who then retreat cannot take effect. This is just like a plant that is expected to grow in a cellar, whereas it can only flourish in sunlight. The vain person cannot thrive. So they develop onward under the repercussions of this trait. Once they have reincarnated, they do not have the strength to accrue beneficial influences to themselves. Instead of fashioning their organs in a healthy manner, they elaborate a sickly organic system. How we therefore develop as human beings through life, what we become, is not only evinced by our physical condition, but also by our moral and intellectual states. Only when we are no longer on the spiritual plane do natural and spiritual laws work in parallel. Between death and a new birth, they are one and the same. Natural laws and spiritual laws together forming a single unity. Forces of nature are implanted into our souls where they work destructively if they are the consequence of immoral deeds in preceding lives, but which work fruitfully if they are the consequence of moral deeds. This applies not only to our inner configuration, but also to what approaches us externally in the form of our karma. The fundamental feature of Devakan is that there no discrepancy exists between natural and spiritual laws. This is also the case for the seer, who has genuinely penetrated into supersensible realms. These suprasensory realms are quite different from such kingdoms as apply in the physical plane. It is simply not possible for the seer to make the distinctions that materialists make by maintaining that it is merely an objective law of nature. In truth, standing behind any such objective law of nature, there is a spiritual law. The seer cannot, for instance, walk across an arid field or a flooded area, cannot be aware of a volcanic eruption, without thinking that behind all natural phenomena are spiritual powers, spiritual beings. For the seer, a volcanic eruption is simultaneously a moral deed, even if the moral is perhaps on quite a different level from what you might at first allow yourself to imagine. People who constantly confuse the physical world with higher worlds will say, well, if innocent people are annihilated, how can one think of this as being a moral act? Appraising it in these terms would be grossly parochial, as would the opposing appraisal be, that is, if one were to view it as an avenging punishment from God, especially for those people living directly by the volcano. Both these opinions can only originate from a Philistine point of view on a physical level. Such views are not the crux of the matter. It can be a matter of far wider, more universal implications. People who live on the slopes of a volcano and whose possessions are destroyed by eruptions may be completely innocent within the terms of this life and will be compensated later. This does not mean that we should harden our hearts and fail to help them, something which would again be a barbarous interpretation of the facts. And yet it is the case with volcanic eruptions that during the course of Earth evolution, certain things have taken place through human agency which have hindered humankind's overall advance. It is those beneficial gods who have to work at offsetting and balancing this, so that in fact compensation for such natural events is generated. The connection between all these phenomena is sometimes only visible in the depths of the occult. In this way, recompense can be made for events that run counter to the course of spiritual advancement, the genuine progress of humanity, and which are perpetrated by human beings themselves. Every incident, to its very foundations, and even when it is an act of nature, is simultaneously a moral event. Spiritual beings in higher worlds are the bearers of this morality, and it is they who stand behind physical events. If you just imagine a world in which it is impossible to speak of a divergent separation of natural and spiritual laws, a world where, expressed differently, righteousness reigns as a law of nature, then you have imagined the Devaconic world. There is, therefore, no need for punishment, even of punishable deeds, to be meted out arbitrarily, but through the same inevitability that causes fire to set light to combustible material, immorality destroys itself, and morality nurtures itself. So we see that the innermost characteristic, as it were, that deepest, most vital nerve of existence, is utterly dissimilar for differing realms. We can form no image of these distinctive worlds if we cannot focus on their radically divergent idiosyncrasies, which can well be summarized as physical realm, Kamaloka, Devakan. The physical world in which natural and spiritual worlds run in a parallel series of factual data, the realm of Kamaloka, in which human beings are enclosed within themselves as in the prison of their own existence, the realm of Devakan, which is the pure converse of the physical world, where natural and spiritual laws coincide, being one and the same. These are the three categories, and if you focus on them closely and try to feel how radically different from our own a world can be, in which what is moral and intellectual, as well as the law of aesthetics, are simultaneously natural laws, then you will sense the nature of existence in the Devaconic realm. When we encounter a lovely or an unsightly face in the physical world, we have as little justification to behave toward the less attractive-looking person, as though they were to be rejected at a soul-spiritual level, as we have to treat an attractive-appearing person as though we ought to elevate them as regards their soul-spiritual disposition. This is quite different in Devakan. There we encounter no unsightliness. That is not encumbered with indebtedness, nor someone who, as a result of their previous incarnation, is placed under the necessary obligation of bearing in a present incarnation an unsightly countenance, yet who is presently engaged in being truthful and honest, in which case we cannot possibly encounter them in an ugly form, because they will certainly have transformed their ugliness into beauty. It is equally true that those who are vain, mendacious, and ruthless are transformed into ugly deformity in Devakan. However, something else is also true. In normal everyday life, we do not see ugly faces who continuously self-detract, nor lovely faces who continuously self-enhance. But in Devakan, this is the case. What is ugly is the manifestation of continuous destruction, and we can perceive nothing beautiful of which we cannot presuppose that it is a work in continuous process of furtherance, of fruitful advancement. We must relate totally differently toward the psychic realm of Devakan from the way in which we relate to the physical world. You need to differentiate these sensations, appreciating the essentials upon which they all depend, so that you internalize not only external portrayals, but that you take with you the feelings and perceptions associated with what spiritual science describes. If you try to bestir yourself to sense a world in which what is moral, beautiful, intellectually true, equates with the inevitability of a law of nature, you will have a sense of Devakan. This is why we have to do so much work at compiling and synthesizing, so that what we work on can, as it were, be melded together into a feeling. It is impossible, at the flick of a wrist, to reach real knowledge of what spiritual science gradually needs to make clear to the world. There are certainly many well-intentioned people who query, why does so much have to be learned in spiritual science? Do we have to go back to being students? After all, it depends on feeling. Yes, it does depend on feeling, but on the right feelings, and these first need to be elaborated. That is the case with everything. After all, it would be much pleasanter for painters if they didn't need to learn all those techniques, and if paint wasn't so tardy in covering the canvas, rather than just being breathed onto it for a finished work. The peculiar thing in our world is that the more things tend toward the spiritual, the harder it is for people to grasp that it is not just a matter of breathing. In music, you would hardly expect someone untutored to be a composer, quite obviously. The same could be said of painting, though to a slightly lesser extent. For poetry, even less. Otherwise, there would be far more poets. Indeed, there has hardly ever been a less poetic age. Yet there are plenty of poets. One doesn't have to have learned this skill. One only needs, and this has nothing to do with poetry, to have learned to write by hand and to express one's thoughts. Philosophizing requires even less. This is thought to be obvious, as anyone can have an opinion on world events and perspectives on life because they can take a position. You encounter again and again that it means nothing that someone has researched and understood a subject, using all available inner means. Today it is deemed obvious that the perspective of one who has worked long and hard to understand and to share even a small segment of world mysteries enjoys equal validity in the opinion of someone who only intends to have an opinion at all. Nowadays, basically everyone is considered to be a person of worldwide perspective, and then a theosophist to boot. Some think even less is needed for this. It ought to suffice that you know not even the three founding principles of the Theosophical Society, but only acknowledge the first of them, just as you wish. All you really need is to acknowledge with a degree of truthfulness that you are a loving human being. Whether you are or are not is not at issue here. Then you are a theosophist and will have the right feelings. Thus, we continually slide downhill when it comes to valuing findings from a given standpoint and the ability to discriminate, starting with music and moving via areas that demand less and less, until we end up with theosophy. Because here it suffices, unlike what would be expected of painting, that you just breathe. We are founding the core of a human brotherhood. We are theosophists. No studying required. However, it depends on us working with all our strength so that whatever insight we gain for ourselves is ultimately gathered into feelings or sensing, which only then, through their coloration, give rise to the loftiest, most truthful knowledge. Start by wrestling your way through to a feeling for the world bearing the imprint of natural and spiritual laws coinciding. If you work seriously at this task, however hard you may have worked on this or that theory before, you will be making an impression on the realm of Devakan. If you have really worked at such sentience, not just fantasized about doing so, but have devoted years to the thorough pursuit of it, then these perceived feelings, these nuanced percepts, will have a power to help you advance further than the nuances themselves can reach. You will have become true through seriously concerted study. You will then not be far from the nuances of feeling springing up and actually laying out before you the nature of Devakan. Because when these nuanced feelings are truly honed, they become a capacity for vision. So, when local branch work is patiently pursued, is practiced solely on the basis of honesty, free of all sensationalism, then these centers of work will be as they should. Schools where individuals are nurtured toward the spheres of clairvoyance. Only those who have no expectation of this, or who do not wish to cooperate with others, can falsely speculate around today's themes. The end of Lecture 5.